Thank you for downloading the Start the Week podcast from BBC Radio 4. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. Hello. Free thought and the bits, the curbs upon it. That's the theme running through today's programme. Asma Jahangir is a Pakistani lawyer who was held under house arrest during the recent emergency. She's also the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion and Belief. Jim Al-Khalili is a nuclear physicist born in Baghdad who's been researching the forgotten history of Arabic science, extraordinary discoveries 1,000 years ago, not least in Baghdad's House of Wisdom. And will be applying some of the issues about freedom of speech and belief to the work of the great John Milton, born 400 years ago, with the historian of thought Quentin Skinner. First, though, consider these propositions. Islam means surrender of independence of mind. Its culture involves extreme incuriosity about the outside non-Islamic world, and the Islamist terrorists have, however, learned from the West, but unfortunately from Hitler and from Stalin. Some of the propositions in Martin Amis's collection of post-September the 11th writings, The Second Plane. Martin, this involves journalism, it involves essays, it involves pieces of fiction and so on. It has brought down a storm of criticism on your head. Did you know what you were getting yourself into?
Yeah, well, I mean, this subject is completely radioactive, and you know that if they run a Geiger counter over your computer, then it's going to rattle a lot on this theme. I think partly because you're writing about an ideology, or actually an ideology within a religion, and you're finding all around you that a different kind of ideology has been at work in this country for a generation, and it's a fascinating clash of ideologies, not of civilizations.
The ideology in this country being what?
Multiculturalism, relativism, levelism, and all the other words for it. And I do think that our moral sense has been completely stupefied by a generation of this kind of thought, begun, by the way, by me, by my generation, the 68ers, you know, who came off the barricades and then went into the universities and inculcated this polite fiction known as, or this obvious fraud known as multiculturalism, which no one can really believe in, and they have to contort themselves to pretend that they do.
Mm. And you have taken up arms, or taken up pen, as it were.
Well, except I'd like to say that I have no affiliation. And you notice in argument, in public events, that as soon as you say a certain kind of thing, someone says, oh, Daily Telegraph, or, oh, Israel Lobby. Mm. My only affiliation, I like to think, is with common sense. But the landscape is so, the mental atmosphere is so ideologized that you get an ideology imputed to you, you know, as soon as you open your mouth on it.
And do you think, you talk about the effect of multiculturalism, do you think that's caused an intellectual loss of nerve?
Well, yes, and a moral loss of nerve. I mean, the deal with multiculturalism is that the only culture you're allowed to disapprove of is your own. The other day I asked an audience at the ICA, I said, hands up those who feel morally superior to the Taliban. And about 120 people there, and I'd say 40 trembling arms were raised. Now, we all know the kind of thing the Taliban does, and I think we'd find a lot more clarity if we looked at Islamism or jihadism as a feminist issue. And the Taliban, not satisfied with getting women out of public life, actually insisted on blacking up the windows of the houses that they were confined to, so that they couldn't be seen, but also to deny them sunlight. Now, the audience at the ICA, in their, you know, if they were to tell the truth, would admit to feeling moral superiority. But it wasn't that. It was a statement of principle. You don't feel morally superior to anyone except America, and by extension, Israel.
So this is the moment when liberalism has become so liberal that it approves of illiberality, particularly when directed against itself.
Yeah, I mean, it was often said, and has been said for a long time, that liberal democracy would never be able to, you know, advance liberal democracy would not have the resolve to defend itself. I don't think it's under threat. And, you know, many a historian and thinker, I think, values imperturbability too much. But it's true that all that Islamism can dominate is the evening news at the moment. But that's not nothing in a in an age of anomie.
One of the things that struck your critics about this writing, for instance, is that it's quite angry. There's quite a lot of angry writing here. And I wondered to the extent to which you had been, as it were, primed and prepared for writing these pieces by what happened to Salman Rushdie some time ago.
Well, as he himself said, that was the first bird across the sky, the first portent of aggression from Islam, but very much an Iranian. I mean, Islam sort of came out of nowhere in 2001. We'd had this running battle with Iran since the revolution of 79, but Islam had never looked monolithic, never looked concerted until then. It certainly did affect me, and you know.
And you say you're not an Islamophobe, you're an Islamismophobe.
I would actually refine it further. Francis Fukuyama has said that you know, Islamism is sometimes nothing more worrying than, you know, a religious movement to impose Sharia law and etc. in, for example, Turkey. But jihadism is the one that is totalitarian, homophobic, misogynist, racist, genocidal, and all the rest of it. And if we can't spot an enemy there, you'd think with the 20th century so fresh in our minds that we would know a thing or two about death cultism, where you lower the value of human life conceivably to your own advantage. We should be able to spot these you know, intensely ideologized enemies.
And you make a very clear connection between jihadism and Leninism in terms of cell structure, but also of, I suppose, the tone or mode of thinking.
Yeah, well, it's and Nazism, and the key theme is irrationalism, hatred of reason, and it's very striking indeed that both Lenin and Hitler and Stalin never let the word reason go by in their writings and speeches without attaching some scornful adjective to it, like miserable reason, abject reason. You know, when you turn your back, when you become a rationalist on principle, it's very empowering for a while, just as lowering the value of human life is empowering, because for a moment, for a while, everything,
it's a kind of freedom.
Everything looks possible, and that's why Stalin admired it so much.
There are in this collection of writings things that, you know, have offended a lot of people. Some of the things that you've said about Iran, for instance. You didn't edit it subsequently. This is a collection of what you wrote at the time, without retrospective editing. Are there things, therefore, in it that you now regret?
Yes, there are. But if it has value, it is as a record of coming to terms with something that, you know, it hasn't been assimilated quite how weird, how macabre this passage of history is. And I wanted to include the shock and the fever of making a response to it.
Jim Al-Khalou.
Yes, I would class myself as a liberal rationalist, and I worry, like many liberals, about this issue of cultural relativism and moral equivalence. I mean, as Andrew says, you deliberately haven't edited in hindsight, and a lot of the earlier essays were immediately after 9/11, where clearly, you know, people were still trying to come to terms with it. But I wonder whether, you're very critical of religion. And yet you class yourself, interestingly, as now an agnostic. Is that because you define atheism as some sort of extreme, absolute disbelief in God? I mean, in which case there's no such thing as atheism, right?
No, but the idea that you see bruited around now, that there's religious belief of fanaticism on one side, and fanatical atheism or enlightenment fundamentalism on the other, is a philosophical non-starter, surely. I mean, there's no warrant for action in atheism. It's open and shut, and it just ends there. The idea of two wings with, in the middle, you know, a few
moderate believers and one or two laconic agnostics, it just doesn't play at all.
Asma.
Well, I just thought that you said that the Islamist ideology came out of nowhere in 2001. This has rather surprised me. Because
not the ideology, no, its presentation to the West. We all know it goes back to
Couture. Presentation, physical presentation into the West. But I hope that you realize that it's been there, physically present very much in the lives of millions of Muslims themselves who have suffered because of it.
Because of Islamism.
Mm. And various movements by women, by secular Muslims all over the world that have been challenging it since 80s, visibly.
One of the propositions made in Martin's book, but elsewhere too, is that if there was a civil war, as it were, of ideas going on inside Islam, it's over, and that in essence, the Islamists have won.
No, well, let me put it that way, that they have an upper hand today, simply because the leadership in the West still does not know what it is all about. And they have very simplistic analysis of it. They don't partner well with the people living in these Muslim environments. They completely ignore democratic forces. They completely ignore civil society. They concentrate too hard on Islamist movements and try and counter it with dictatorships, I think. So the clash that you see in the West is either dictatorship or Islamists. You don't see the large, huge numbers of people sitting there talking about not the kind of multiculturalism that in that way that you talk in the West, but a kind of wanting to live a life which is easygoing as far as religion is concerned.
Well, yes, and I do say that surely the key is the feminine, the female population of these countries. Women are not a minority.
Can I say something? That as far as females are concerned, they are so absent from all religions in terms of decision-making. It's all male-dominated, every religion. I mean, I've seen in my work, I hardly see a woman anywhere when I go and talk to heads of communities. And yet, they are the ones that get the rough end of every religion. So it's not an exclusivity of Islamic religion alone.
Well, maybe for once, we very rarely are able to say it's good old Church of England. Quentin Skinner.
Oh, thank you. I think I've got to say something about Martin's claim about all these people who went into the universities from the barricades and taught multiculturalism. This sounds awfully like people like me. And we're good guys, really. We're studying cultural disciplines. We're interested most fundamentally in a distinction which, as I hear Martin, he's abolishing. That's to say, the distinction between holding a belief that's false and believing that we can say of a belief that we study as historians or anthropologists that they're false. For example, I'm interested in Renaissance philosophy, and lots of people then believed that there were witches in league with the devil and that they should be executed. Well, I mean, it's false that there are witches that are in league with the devil. But to anyone interested in the cultural disciplines, it's absolutely critical that you mustn't call that irrational straight off. You mustn't equate false beliefs with irrational beliefs. There may have been perfectly good reasons by their lights for these people to hold that belief. The duty of the cultural disciplines is to make the accusation of irrationality literally the last thing you ever say. You do everything you can to make sense of their beliefs. And this is what I think is pari passu the case in our current cultural divisions. We really have to listen. We really have to try to see what the inwardness of other belief systems is, even if the propositions that are being advanced strike us as manifestly false.
So is belief in a supernatural being, or the desire for the approval of a supernatural being, as Dennett has recently defined religion, is that irrational?
Well, it is false, I'm saying, but it could well be that somebody had good grounds for holding that to be true, because what it's rational for you to hold to be true depends on lots of your other beliefs. It depends on the belief system within which you're operating. We, none of us, apply all the same criteria to the inspection and criticism of all of our beliefs. We have to live with the fact that some of our colleagues have tremendously wacky beliefs. I mean, you know, I have colleagues who believe that God is three, but he's also one. I don't believe there is a God myself, as far as I can see. If we know anything, we know that. But these are good guys. You have to work with them.
But do you not feel a slight impatience with these beliefs?
No, because I think that I'm more of what you would call a relativist. I mean, I imagine that I have lots of false beliefs myself. I don't know which they are, or I would do something to correct them. But I don't suppose that we're all living in one world in which we either hold your beliefs or we're to be convicted of irrationality.
But I think...
Just before you follow on for this, we are going to carry on the same discussion in essence, but I want to address what you are here to address, Asma, as part of this. Because to remind everyone listening, Asma Jahangir is a human rights lawyer and activist, but also the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion and Belief. And you've been looking at the way, for instance, Muslims are treated in countries like Britain, and are shaking your finger a bit?
I am. I think that the fact that all Muslims are put in one compartment, first of all, I believe is incorrect. And secondly, from what I have seen, the kind of behavior patterns amongst those who are radicalized, so to speak, is different from one region to another. I hate it when people sort of paint it with one brush, either in their favor or against them. For example, I have heard world leaders sort of talk about root causes of Islamist terrorism, which sometimes make me smile, because if poverty was indeed the only root cause of terrorism, then we would have much more to face, much more difficult times. And secondly, it's very easy to put everything in at the doorstep of people who are poor. Mm. You know, for example, in my country, I think the class of people who are deprived in a way economically are very easygoing people. Mm. It's only when you get a bit of power, when you get the taste of it, when you get the opportunity to make associations and to come into groups that you really then found kinds of ideology that gives you this grandeur.
And so you're saying in part that, for instance, profiling, as it's called, which is singling out an angry-looking man with a beard rather than Martin Amis's daughter when you're looking, you're waiting
it's
to get onto
common.
A plane.
It is very common in the West. I believe it's a bad thing. I not only believe it's a bad thing, I think that you are reinforcing exactly what you are opposing.
Because you're dividing people.
But you're dividing. No. The reason that we would, I presume, stand against those people who call themselves Islamist is because they feel that the other is a devil. They want to hoist their beliefs on other people. I don't care what people believe, as long as they don't foist it on me. Mm. And as long as the manifestation does not trample on other people's toes.
We were talking about the sort of civil war or the war of ideas inside Islam. Now, in many respects, probably in almost every respect, Pakistan is on the front line there. You've got, in Afghanistan, a society where if you try to convert to Christianity, you get a death sentence.
Well, so does it in Pakistan.
Well, I was going to say, it's happened as well in Pakistan. It went right up to the Supreme Court.
Right, absolutely. It's mandatory death penalty, and this was in 1995, before the West heard what was happening there. And people started to be blamed of blasphemy. Lawyers stopped taking their cases, and when I did take one of the cases, I was threatened as well. And the judge who acquitted this young boy, who was 14-year-old, where there was absolutely no evidence against him, was subsequently murdered. Now, having lived very close to all this, I have to tell you that there is a link between these forces and the establishments on these countries. They're not working, they're not floating and working on their own. They're being fed through some sources. And if they didn't have links with the governments, they would not have survived that long.
But can you see that for a lot of people, it is an almost unbearably difficult dilemma? For instance, Pakistan. A lot of people in the West say Musharraf may be he's in London at the moment, but he may be a bad guy, he may be a military dictator of a kind, but he is our only line of defence. against what's happening in the north of Afghanistan, against the militants. If he goes, Pakistan becomes... you have turmoil and turbulence, and the way things are going, it'll become an Islamist country.
Well, in my view, I think, again, this is a lack of understanding of our country. You recall that when Benazir Bhutto was assassinated just a few months ago, everybody, just everybody on the road, men, women, beard, no beard, headscarf, no headscarf, were crying with tears. Now, this is a country which is very traditional in many ways, but they did accept a woman and adored her in a way much more than she thought that she was adored till she passed away. So there is, it's a complex situation. What we have is an establishment which is created by the military that is has an ideology, frankly, and it suits the military to have an ideology. So I think that for the world to get rid of Islamist tendencies, it would be best to marginalize the military in Pakistan rather than, you know, try and go after the people that they produce, because the machine is right there in the GHQ in Pakistan, and people do know that. I mean, if you read this book, Deception, it goes into details and research of what is happening, and yet our leaders and your leaders will not look at it because it's too difficult to deal with.
Jim Akhalili.
Yeah, I'm interested, Asma, in what you think about the hope for democracy, true democracy in Pakistan. It links back to something that Martin says in his book about Iraq. You say Iraq is a manufactured state and probably democracy would never work there. I mean, I guess most countries are manufactured in the sense of where you draw the borders, and Pakistan is younger than Iraq as an independent state. Do you think there is real hope for democracy there? The middle classes are getting weaker, we hear, in Pakistan. Is it all running away from us?
Let me say two things. First is there aspiration? There's huge aspiration. And people have fought for democracy for years and years. There has never been a time when there has not been a movement in Pakistan for democracy, and very popular movement. But there is also a fatigue factor. How long can you continue to fight guns and against, you know, a very devious military regime? If they don't kill you directly, they'll have some fundamentalists kill you. So it's not easy that way. Living there is absolutely very risky.
Mm. And what about the elections? Are they going to change things? Are they going to happen for a start? Then are they going to change?
I do not believe that if they went so far as to beat up every lawyer in the country, put most of the judiciary into arrest or house arrest, they're still under house arrest, the Chief Justice, along with his children and wife, that they're going to now turn around and say, well, the ballot speaks for itself. Can we bid goodbye? No, it doesn't happen like that. They have far more to lose. They're playing a very devious game. And unfortunately, you are not understanding it here. We sitting there understood it in the 80s when women came out in the street against Islamization and the military, which was not easy, and beaten up and taken to police stations and told that they were un-Islamic.
So if there is any hope in any of this, Martin Ames, we have to ally ourselves with the good guys, as it were, well, in the Islamic world much more than we have.
I certainly do, or the good forces.
Good guys in a non-gender sense.
I mean, Pakistan is a dysfunctional state, is it not? I mean, it's been ruined by the Taliban.
Well, let me put it straight to you. You know, when you come to Pakistan, you'll realize that it's not dysfunctional. People are so resilient that despite no gas, despite no electricity, people are still continuing to do their work.
The people are, but the government collects no taxes, right? And the black economy dwarfs the white economy.
And yet it continues. It's not like Afghanistan. I mean, I have been to many countries now in my work in the UN. And I am amazed that it still functions, whereas it shouldn't have functioned. And again, I just come back to you and say, there's no such thing as being with the good guys. I think you have to be very clear. Where do you want the world to go? Give democracy a chance. Give people a chance to build their institutions. But we've never got a chance. I mean, all our dictators have been so heavily supported by the West, and your civil societies have not questioned their leadership. Every time there's a transition, all resources are pulled out. They are watched very carefully. And you have the most corrupt, the most inept dictator who, on the face of it, is delusional, and everybody thinks he's a great guy.
Mm. We're going to carry on talking about the Islamic and Arab world. Jim Al-Khalili, I'd just like you to read something which comes from your own researches.
Yes, this is a quote from the Book of Animals, which was written by an Abbasid scholar who was born in 781 AD. He says, "Animals engage in a struggle for existence, for resources, to avoid being eaten and to breed. Environmental factors influence organisms to develop new characteristics to ensure survival, thus transforming into new species. Animals that survive to breed can pass on their successful characteristics to offspring."
Now, that clearly comes from one of Charles Darwin's notebooks.
Clearly.
Although, as you say, it's 1,000 years earlier. And it's one of the examples of what you've been studying, the House of Wisdom in Baghdad and the Golden Age of Arabic science. You call it Arabic science rather than Islamic science.
Yes, very carefully so. The Abbasid period, the Golden Age of science in that part of the world 1,000 years ago, was very inclusive. There were many Christian and Jewish scholars, certainly in the early periods, who carried out a lot of the translations from the Greek texts. There were also many non-Arabs there, a lot of Persians. There's very, very strong Persian influence in that period. But the commonality amongst them is the Arabic language. Mm. So the one thing we don't appreciate in the West is that for 700 years, the international language of science was Arabic. And so even non-native Arab speakers would write their scientific treatises and textbooks in Arabic.
A lot of people will have at the back of their mind, yes, we know that Arabic science produced some interesting philosophy and some interesting mathematics. What surprised me about your work is just the sheer range, not simply the optics and the mathematics, but, for instance, chemistry. Alkali, I didn't realise, is an Arabic word.
Yes, what's interesting is that this goes back to, again, an Iraqi chemist called Jaber ibn Hayyan, and the Arabic word for chemistry is alchemia, which is what's got translated into alchemy. And in a way, the West has now confused the two, chemistry and alchemy. One is a science, one is a pseudoscience based on superstition. And they have in mind that, I mean, this guy's known as Jaber the Alchemist, not realising that he carried out a lot of very, very interesting... He was regarded as the first true chemist.
Basic chemistry experiments. There are lots of extraordinary characters, some of them known by their Latin names, as Avicenna.
Avicenna, Averroes, and so on, yes.
But there's an amazing guy that I'd never heard of, I have to completely put my hands up, called Al-Biruni.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about him and why he matters so much.
Well, in my view, he is the greatest of all the Arabic scholars. And in fact, he was a Persian. He was a contemporary of Avicenna. He was born in today's Uzbekistan. He travelled very widely around India and Afghanistan and so on. And I think in the breadth, I mean, he was a true polymath, in the breadth of the contributions he made to philosophy and mathematics and astronomy. I mean, he developed trigonometry. He wrote a book that is almost on par with Newton's Principia.
He got the world's circumference virtually right purely by trigonometry.
He measured the height of a mountain in India using trigonometry, and from there he determined the circumference of the Earth to within a couple of hundred miles, which no one had done before. And I mean, really, the only person that I would compare him with is that he's on par with Leonardo da Vinci in terms of his true genius. And yet, he doesn't have a Latinized form of his name like his contemporary Avicenna. Avicenna was a star. He was famous. He courted fame. Whereas Al-Biruni was...
He was a bit of a show pony.
He was a bit, yes. Al-Biruni was much more modest, kept himself to himself. And he's, on the whole, pretty much unknown to the West.
Mm. Now, you focused on what you call the House of Wisdom. Just sort of describe what the House of Wisdom was.
It seems that there's a lot of confusion among historians of science. The House of Wisdom, Bayt al-Hikmah, started off as...
This is in
Baghdad, yes. Mm. The caliph who built Baghdad, al-Mansur, is thought to have created a library where he gathered scholars to start translating Greek texts. But that's all it was, a library. Mm. But it wasn't until al-Ma'mun, who is the son of the famous Harun al-Rashid, who crops up in Arabian Nights, that's the famous caliph of Baghdad, but it was his son al-Ma'mun who develops this House of Wisdom into an academy. And he brings together Persian, Arab, Christian, Jewish scholars to work together. He had apparently had a dream that Aristotle came to him and said, you have to go out and seek wisdom wherever you find it. And so he lived by this dream for the rest of his life and tried to gather these scholars in Baghdad. And that really kicked off the golden age of science.
I was going to say it's an Eastern Renaissance, but it's more like an Eastern Naissance because it starts rather than picks up again. And it's a period when, in early Islamic thought, there's no contradiction between Quranic teaching and going out and investigating in science and curiosity, to pick up Martin Amos's term earlier on. So what goes wrong?
Well, it really, the reason why there was this fantastic period was because of the way, it was all down to Islam spreading, of course. I mean, this is the positive face of Islam. But at the time, it was a rationalist movement that thought that to understand the Quran, you had to go out and seek knowledge and understand the world and then use that newfound knowledge to interpret the words in the Quran. What went wrong? Well, partly religious conservatism crept in by the end of the 11th century. Partly the Abbasid Empire itself fragmented and there were many weaker caliphs who no longer were sponsoring and supporting sciences and the arts. So it didn't stop, but it gradually petered out. And so all the big names were all confined to those three centuries between the 8th and the 11th century.
Mm. Who would like to jump in there? Asma?
No, I think this is fascinating, and I think there's far more diversity even in history and even now today in the Islamic world than people would credit it with. But at the same time, what I do worry is also intolerance all the time throughout history. You always find, examples and historical events where intolerance, particularly where people have not agreed with Islamic text, meted out to individuals and groups.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting that even during that period, Al-Ma'mun, the caliph who started the House of Wisdom, carried out an inquisition against the more traditional Muslims who didn't agree with his line of thought. So on the one hand, we say he was a rationalist, he supported science. On the other hand, he wanted to stamp out any theological thinking that didn't really agree with his line.
Yeah, that's what worries me. And Martin, you were speaking, that this intolerance of against freedom of expression is catching up in every society now.
Martin.
Well, the remark about incuriosity was borne out by Bernard Lewis's astonishing statistic, that Spain translates into Spanish more books per year than have been translated into Arabic in the last millennium. What Went Wrong is the title of another book by Bernard Lewis, who instances the invention of the wheel, for example, or the retirement of the wheel under, the more decadent Islam, that the wheel was present but became un-Islamic and was kind of suppressed.
The very opposite of the spirit that...
And Steven Weinberg has said that the science really stopped dead. I mean, the concentration on the Quran, the increase in conservatism must have been quite sudden and quite extreme.
I don't think it was. I mean, a lot of the criticism is levelled against a theological philosopher, Al-Ghazali, who is sort of the Islamic Thomas Aquinas. But I think that was a theological argument. I don't think science ended. It petered out very slowly. There were still instances of great scholars up into the 14th and 15th century.
Well, let's turn to another period where science erupts but also hits some pretty difficult theological barriers. John Milton, 400 years since he was born, and Quentin Skinner, professor of history of ideas, in essence. You've been looking at the question of freedom and freedom of speech in Milton's writing. We all think of Areopagitica, this great sort of defence of freedom of the press. But to start with, let's be clear, Milton's freedom is by no means freedom for everyone.
That is, that's the first thing to say. What I'm interested in is what Milton understands by the concept of freedom, because his is a rather different concept from ours. But it would be a different question to ask who deserves to have that freedom. And there you would meet with the limitations on his sensibilities, the commonplace limitations of his time. But, of course, freedom of the religion does not mean freedom for Catholics, for example.
Never mind Muslims.
Never mind Muslims.
It means freedom for Protestant men, in essence, doesn't it?
Well, it tends to go back to something that Martin was talking about earlier. It turns out to mean that it's freedom for people who agree with him.
He was, of course, the great propagandist, as it were, a great writer for republicanism and the Cromwellian period.
Yes.
And a lot of his great prose writings come from that and then suddenly stop again.
That's absolutely right. In fact, the prose writings exactly span the two decades of the Civil War period, his first in 1641 and the last in 1660. After that, of course, he can't write any political works because he is a Republican and he's lucky to escape with his life.
And if he was magically transmogrified and listening to the debate about freedom that we're having now,
yes,
what would he make of it?
He would say that we are slaves.
Mm. We're slaves in what sense?
Well, his view of freedom doesn't focus, as we tend to do, on the concept of free action. He's interested in what he calls a free person. What does it mean to be a free person, and what does it mean to live in a free state? Now, what it means is not to be a slave. Well, what is it to be a slave? A slave is somebody who is dependent upon the arbitrary will of somebody else and thus lives at their mercy.
And our form of government, though we call it democratic, he would regard as a form of slavery, despite the fact that one Gordon Brown, I note recently, has cited him in defence of freedom.
Well, in defence of a liberal view of freedom, which Milton does not hold. I mean, Milton thinks that any system in which you are subject to arbitrary power is a system of slavery, and that is always the vocabulary that he uses in the great works that you cite. First of all, in the Areopagitica, but most of all in The Tenure of Kings and Magistrates, his defence of the regicide. And the reason that he would be horrified at our describing our arrangements as democratic is, first of all, and most seriously, that the executive dominates the legislative so that we do not actually, as the sovereign people, have any say, for example, in the appointment of ministers. He would think that fantastic.
Mm.
And secondly, that we retain the royal prerogative, which is held by the executive for the time being and includes very wide powers. That's why we're in Iraq.
I mean, to be fair to Brown, he has started to move on things like the declaration of war by Parliament.
I quite agree.
And that's Miltonic? A little Miltonic?
It's totally Miltonic. That's to say, he's recognising that that's an arbitrary power. That's to say, no one has consented to it and it isn't part of the law of the land. So, yes, that was a silent revolution that happened in his first week in power, the agreement to give up that royal prerogative of war and peace, held by the executive up to that moment.
I was very struck by reading through some of the works that you cite, where Milton says, "No one can be so stupid to deny that all men naturally were born free." And you suddenly see, jumping ahead to the American Revolution and to Marx.
Oh,
and
he
men.
Is. Yes.
Mm. And men.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, this document is very crucial for the Founding Fathers, certainly. Mm. And I suppose Areopagitica in particular.
Mm. What do they make of it? Jim?
I was interested that in Paradise Lost, Milton talks about men being born free and that they have free will in the sense that, you know, somehow the future isn't predetermined. How does this sort of... I mean, his religious thinking is that, you know, God is therefore not omniscient and yet God is omnipotent.
Yes. Well, it's very hard to get it clear. There's a big discussion in Book 3 of Paradise Lost in which it's crucial to the epic, because the epic is also a tragedy, that Adam should have freedom, because if he doesn't, then there is no tragedy in Eve's being seduced by the serpent and his eating of the tree of knowledge. So he has to have free will, and God says in Book 3, "Free I made them, and they will enthrall themselves." But the strangeness is, of course, that's very unorthodox Calvinism, that it goes with the Calvinist understanding that God is omnipotent will, and thus has total foreknowledge, of course, of what is going to happen. So Milton believes that foreknowledge is compatible with freedom.
Hmm. Martin?
The great contradiction in Milton, in Paradise Lost, and I was thrilled as an undergraduate, as we all were, to read William Empson's Milton's God, which says very forthrightly that Milton was of the devil's party. But the great contradiction, the war in heaven, books 5 and 6, why does Satan rise up? And he rises up in opposition to the hereditary principle, does he not?
Well, in part, but you're quite right. In Book 5, it's Gabriel, isn't it, reporting the war in heaven, and so reporting what Satan says. The truly disturbing thing which the great Empson noticed is that the language of the republicanism that Milton supports in his prose is Satan's language. That's to say, he's objecting to being a free person subject to complete dependence upon the will of God, because that's to live as a slave.
And it's just to make it clear that it's when God announces that, as it were, the ascendancy of Christ, his son.
Yes.
That through sense of injured merit, it says in Book One, something I always attributed to Gordon Brown in his dealings with Tony Blair, the satanic vice of injured merit. But doesn't this sort of... And he was, you know, a Christian of desperate sincerity.
No question of that, indeed. But I think that what makes Empson's insight so disconcerting, and of course Blake has it because it's he who speaks of being of the devil's party, is... we're out of time.
No, we're not out of time.
Oh, very good.
Do finish the thought.
The thought is that what Satan says is we are all free and equal. We've been born free, we've been born equal. How do we come to be living in complete dependence upon the will of this person? Now, Abdiel, in reply, says, you can't say that to God. This is Jim's point. It's different, the kingdom of heaven, because there is an omnipotent will and we just are slaves. But that's what Satan is protesting about.
Well, I don't normally finish the programme by saying good old Satan, but good old Satan. Thank you to all my guests. Quentin Skinner is going to be discussing Milton as a theorist of liberty at Christ's College, Cambridge on Wednesday. The Second Plane, that book by Martin Amis, is published on Thursday. Asma Jahangir is giving an Oxford Amnesty lecture on Wednesday and speaking at York University on Thursday. And Jim Al-Khalili is talking about the House of Wisdom at the Royal Society on Wednesday. Next week, the novelist Peter Carey on his latest book, His Illegal Self. Tim Harford on the economics that drive all the decisions of our lives, from marriage to drug addiction. And David Willetts on how much governments can really influence our behaviour. But for now, thank you and goodbye.